underlying tone of satisfaction to her voice, though. She was quite pleased not to have to share the limelight with her friend. "Do let me present him to you," she said suddenly, and folding her fan, slipped her arm through mine. I was taken entirely by surprise and couldn't think of a way to extricate myself before I found myself towed into the group around André, with Miss Chu chattering brightly to him, laughing up at him, her hand familiarly on his arm. He smiled at her, then switched his gaze to me, his eyes warm and lively. "I'm enchanted, Lady John," he said in a soft, husky voice. "Your servant, madam."
Yes, I said abruptly, quite forgetting the usual form. Yes. Glad to meet you.
I pulled my hand out of his before he could kiss it, disconcerting him, and backed away. He blinked, but Miss Chu reclaimed his attention at once, and I turned away, going to stand near the door where there was at least a little air. I was covered in cold sweat and vibrating in every limb.
"Oh, there you are, Mother Claire."
Willie popped up beside me, two half-melted ices in his hands, sweating freely. "Here."
"Thank you."
I took one, noting absently that my fingers were nearly as cold as the misted silver cup.
"Are you quite all right, Mother Claire?"
He bent down to look at me, concerned.
"You look quite pale, as though you'd seen a ghost."
He winced in brief apology at this clumsy reference to death. But I made an effort to smile back. Not a terribly successful effort, because he was right. I had just seen a ghost. Major John André was the British officer with whom Benedict Arnold, hero of Saratoga, and still a legendary patriot, would eventually conspire. And the man who would go to the gallows for his part in that conspiracy sometime in the next 3 years.
"Had you better sit down for a bit?"
Willie was frowning in concern, and I made an effort to shake off my cold horror. I didn't want him offering to leave the ball to see me home. He was plainly having a good time. I smiled at him, barely feeling my lips.
"No, that's all right," I said. "I think I'll just step outside for some air."
Chapter 99. A Butterfly in a Butcher's Yard. Rollo lay under a bush, noisily devouring the remains of a squirrel he'd caught. Ian sat on a rock, contemplating him. The city of Philadelphia lay just out of sight. He could smell the haze of fire, the stink of thousands of people living cheek by jowl. Could hear the clop and rattle of people going there on the road that lay only a few hundred yards away. And somewhere, within a mile of him, hidden in that mass of buildings and people, was Rachel Hunter. He wanted to step out in the road, stride down it into the heart of Philadelphia, and begin taking the place apart, brick by brick, until he found her.
"Where do we begin, Naku?" he said to Rollo. "The print shop, I suppose."
He'd not been there, but supposed it wouldn't be hard to find. Fergus and Masali would give him shelter and food, he thought, feeling his stomach growl. And perhaps Germaine and the girls could help him hunt for Rachel.
Perhaps Auntie Claire could. Well, he knew she wasn't a witch or a fairy, but there was no doubt at all in his mind that she was something, and perhaps she would be able to find Rachel for him.
He waited for Rollo to finish his meal, then rose, an extraordinary sense of warmth suffusing him, though the day was overcast and cool. Could he find her that way, he wondered? Walk through the streets playing the children's game of warmer, colder, growing steadily warmer as he approached her more closely, coming to her at last, just before he burst into flame.
"You could help, you know," he said reproachfully to Rollo.
He'd tried getting Rollo to backtrack to her at once when the dog had found him, but the dog had been so berserk with joy at Ian's return that there was no speaking to him. That was a thought, though. If they somehow ran across her trail, Rollo might take it up, now that he was more sober-minded. He smiled crookedly at that thought. The bulk of the British army was encamped at Germantown, but there were thousands of soldiers quartered in Philadelphia itself.
As well ask the dog to follow the scent of a butterfly through a butcher's yard. Well, we won't find her sitting here, he said to Rollo and stood up. Come on, dog.
Chapter 100 Lady-in-Waiting. I was waiting for things to make sense. Nothing did. I had lived in John Gray's house with its gracious stair and crystal chandelier, its Turkey rugs and fine china for nearly a month, and yet I woke each day with no idea where I was, reaching across an empty bed for Jamie. I could not believe he was dead. Could not. I shut my eyes at night and heard him, breathing slow and soft in the night beside me. Felt his eyes on me, humorous, lusting, annoyed, alight with love. Turned half a dozen times a day, imagining I heard his step behind me. Opened my mouth to say something to him. And more than once, really had spoken to him, realizing only when I heard the words dwindle on the empty air that he wasn't there. Each realization crushed me anew, and yet none reconciled me to his loss. I had, with shrinking mind, envisioned his death. He would so have hated drowning, of all the ways to die. I could only hope that the sinking of the ship had been violent and that he had gone unconscious into the water, because otherwise he couldn't give up. He wouldn't have. He would have swum and kept swimming, endless miles from any shores, alone in the empty deep. Swam stubbornly because he could not give up and let himself sink. Swam until that powerful frame was exhausted, until he couldn't lift a hand again. And then I rolled over and pressed my face hard into my pillow, heart squeezing with horror. What a bloody, bloody waste, I said into the feathers, clenching handfuls of pillow in my fists as hard as I could. If he died in battle, at least. I rolled back over and shut my eyes, biting my lip until the blood came. At last my breathing slowed, and I opened my eyes on darkness again and resumed waiting. Waiting for Jamie. Some time later, the door opened and a slice of light from the hallway fell into the room. Lord John came in, setting a candle on the table by the door, and approached the bed. I didn't look at him, but knew he was looking down at me. I lay on my bed, staring at the ceiling, or rather, looking through it to the sky, dark, full of stars and emptiness. I hadn't bothered to light a candle, but I didn't curse the darkness either. Only looked into it, waiting.
You are very lonely, my dear, he said, with great gentleness, and I know it. Will you not let me bear you company, for a little time at least?
I said nothing, but did move over a little, and didn't resist when he lay down beside me and gathered me carefully into his arms. I rested my head on his shoulder, grateful for the comfort of simple touch and human warmth, though it didn't reach the depths of my desolation. Try not to think. Accept what there is. Don't think about what there is not. I lay still, listening to John breathe. He breathed differently from Jamie, shallower, faster, a very slight catch in his breath. It dawned on me, slowly, that I wasn't alone in my desolation or my loneliness, and that I knew all too well what had happened last time this state of affairs had become obvious to both of us. Granted, we weren't drunk, but I thought he couldn't but remember it as well.
Do you wish me to comfort you? He said quietly. I do know how, you know.
And reaching down, he moved a finger very slowly, in such a place and with such exquisite delicacy that I gasped and jerked away. I know you do. I did have a moment's curiosity as to how exactly he had learned, but wasn't about to ask. "It's not that I don't appreciate the thought. I do," I assured him, and felt my cheeks flush hotter. It's only...
"That you would feel unfaithful," he guessed.
He smiled a little sadly.
"I understand."
There was a long silence then, and a sense of growing awareness.
"You wouldn't?" I asked.
He lay quite still as if asleep, but wasn't.
"A standing cock is quite blind, my dear," he said at last, eyes still shut. "Surely you know that, physician that you are."
"Yes," I said, "I do know that." And taking him gently but firmly in hand, I dealt with him in tender silence, avoiding any thought of whom he might see in his mind's eye. Colenso Baragwanath ran as though his boot heels were on fire. He burst into the Fox Tavern near the foot of State Street and barreled through the chat room into the card room at the back.
"They found him," he panted. "The old man axe, with the axe."
Captain Lord Ellesmere was already rising to his feet. To Colenso, he looked some 8 feet tall and awful in aspect. The place where the doctor had stitched his head was bristly with new hair, but the black stitching still showed. His eyes might have been shooting flames, but Colenso was afraid to look too closely. His chest heaved from running, and he was out of breath, but he couldn't have thought of a thing to say, even so.
"Where?" said the captain.
He spoke very softly, but Colenso heard him, and backed toward the door, pointing. The captain picked up the pair of pistols he had laid aside, and, putting them in his belt, came toward him.
"Show me," he said.
Rachel sat on the tall stool behind the print shop's counter, head on her hand. She'd wakened with a sense of pressure in her head, probably from the impending storm, and it had ripened into a throbbing headache. She would rather have gone back to friend John's house to see if Claire might have a tea that would help, but she'd promised Masali that she would come and mind the shop while her friend took the children to the cobbler to have their shoes mended and Henri Christian fitted for a pair of boots, for his feet were too short and wide to fit his sister's outgrown shoes. At least the shop was quiet. Only one or two folk had come in, and only one of those had spoken to her, asking the way to Slip Alley. She rubbed her stiff neck, sighing, and let her eyes close. Masali would be back soon. Then she could go and lie down with a wet rag on her head, and... The bell above the print shop door went ting, and she straightened up, a welcoming smile forming on her face. She saw the visitor, and the smile died.
"Leave,"
she said, scrambling off the stool, measuring the distance between her and the door into the house.
"Leave this minute."
If she could get through and out the back.
"Stand still," said Archbug, in a voice like rusty iron.
"I know what thee means to do," she said, backing up a step, "and I do not blame thee for thy grief, thy rage. But thee must know it is not right what thee intend. The Lord cannot wish thee to..."
"Be quiet, lass," he said,
and his eyes rested on her with an odd sort of gentleness.
"Not yet. We'll wait for him."
"For him?"
"Aye, him."
With that, he lunged across the counter and seized her arm. She screamed and struggled but couldn't get loose, and he flipped up the flap in the counter and dragged her through, pushing her hard against the table of books so that the stacks wobbled and fell with papery thumps.
"Thee cannot hope to..."
"I have nae hope,"
he interrupted, quite calm. The axe was in his belt. She saw it, bare and silver.
"I need none."
"Thee will surely die,"
she said, and made no effort to keep her voice from trembling.
"The soldiers will take thee."
"Why, they will."
His face softened a little then, surprisingly.
"I shall see my wife again."
"I could not counsel suicide,"
she said, edging as far away as she could get.
"But if thee does intend to die in any case, why does thee insist upon... upon staining thy death, thy soul, with violence.
You think vengeance a stain?
The beetling white brows lifted.
It is a glory, lass. My glory. My duty to my wife.
Well, certainly not mine, she said heatedly. Why should I be forced to serve thy beastly vengeance? I have done nothing to thee or thine. He wasn't listening.
Not to her, at least.
He had turned a little, his hand going to his axe, and smiled at the sound of racing footsteps. Ian, she shrieked, don't come in.
He came in, of course. She grasped a book and flung it at the old man's head, but he dodged it easily and grabbed her by the wrist once more, his axe in hand. Let her go, said Ian, hoarse with running.
His chest heaved and sweat was running down his face. She could smell him even above the old man's musty reek. She jerked her hand out of Archbug's clasp, speechless with horror. Don't kill him, she said to both of them. Neither of them listened.
I told you, did I not?
Arch said to Ian. He sounded reasonable, a teacher pointing out the proof of a theorem. Quod erat demonstrandum. QED.
Get away from her, Ian said.
His hand hovered above his knife, and Rachel, choking on the words, said, Ian, don't. They must not, please. Ian gave her a look of furious confusion. But she held his eyes, and his hand dropped away. He took a deep breath, and then a quick step to the side. Bug whirled to keep him in range of the axe, and Ian slid fast in front of Rachel, screening her with his body.
Kill me then, he said deliberately to Bug. Do it.
No, Rachel said. That is not what I... No!
Come here, lass, Arch said,
and put out his good hand, beckoning.
Dinna be afraid. I'll make it fast.
Ian shoved her hard, so she slammed into the wall and knocked her head, and braced himself before her, crouched and waiting. Unarmed, because she'd asked it.
You'll fucking kill me first, he said, in a conversational tone. No, said Archbug. You'll wait your turn.
The old eyes measured him, cold and clever, and the axe moved a little, eager. Rachel shut her eyes and prayed, finding no words but praying all the same in a frenzy of fear. She heard a sound and opened them. A long grey blur shot through the air, and in an instant Archbug was on the ground, Rollo on top of him, snarling and snapping at the old man's throat. Old he might be, but still hale, and he had the strength of desperation. His good hand seized the dog's throat, pushing back, holding off the slavering jaws, and a long, sinewy arm flung out, axe gripped in a maimed fist, and rose.
No!
Ian dove forward, knocking Rollo aside, grappling for the hand that held the axe. But it was too late. The blade came down with a chunk that made Rachel's vision go white, and Ian screamed. She was moving before she could see, and screamed herself when a hand suddenly seized her shoulder and hurled her backward. She hit the wall and slid down it, landing winded and open-mouthed. There was a writhing ball of limbs, fur, clothes, and blood on the floor before her. A random shoe cracked against her ankle, and she scuttled away, crabwise, staring. There seemed to be blood everywhere, spattered against the counter and the wall, smeared on the floor, and the back of Ian's shirt was soaked with red and clinging, so she saw the muscles of his back straining beneath it. He was kneeling half atop a struggling Archbug, grappling one-handed for the axe, his left arm hanging limp, and Arch was stabbing at his face with stiffened fingers, trying to blind him, while Rollo darted eel-like and bristling into the mass of straining limbs, growling and snapping. Fixed on this spectacle, she was only dimly aware of someone standing behind her, but looked up, uncomprehending, when his foot touched her bum.
"Is there something about you that attracts men with axes?" William asked crossly.
He sighted carefully along his pistol's barrel and fired. Chapter 101 Reddy Vivas. I was pinning up my hair for tea
when there was a scratch at the bedroom door. "Come," John called, in the act of pulling on his boots. The door opened cautiously, revealing the odd little Cornish boy who sometimes served as William's orderly. He said something to John, in which I assumed to be English, and handed him a note. John nodded kindly and dismissed him. "Could you understand what he said?" I asked curiously, as he broke the seal with his thumb.
"Who?" "Oh, Colenso? No, not a word," he said absently,
and pursed his lips in a soundless whistle at whatever he was reading. "What is it?" I asked.
"A note from Colonel Graves," he said, carefully refolding it. "I wonder if..."
There was another knock at the door, and John frowned at it.
"Not now," he said. "Come back later." "Well, I would," said a polite voice in a Scottish accent. "But there's some urgency, Ken."
The door opened, and Jamie stepped in, closing it behind him. He saw me, stood stock still for an instant, and then I was in his arms, the overwhelming warmth and size of him blotting out in an instant everything around me. I didn't know where my blood had gone. Every drop had left my head, and flickering lights danced before my eyes. But none of it was supplying my legs, which had abruptly dissolved under me. Jamie was holding me up and kissing me, tasting of beer and his beard stubble rasping my face, his fingers buried in my hair, and my breasts warmed and swelled against his chest. "Oh, there it is," I murmured.
"What?"
he asked, breaking off for a moment. "My blood." I touched my tingling lips. "Do that again."
"Oh, I will," he assured me. "But there are a number of English soldiers in the neighbourhood, and I think..."
The sound of pounding came from below, and reality snapped back into place like a rubber band. I stared at him, and sat down very suddenly, my heart pounding like a drum. "Why the bloody hell aren't you dead?" He lifted one shoulder in a brief shrug, the corner of his mouth turning up. He was very thin, brown-faced and dirty. I could smell his sweat and the grime of long-worn clothes, and the faint whiff of vomit. He'd not been long off a boat.
"Delay for a few seconds longer, Mr. Fraser, and you may well go back to being dead."
John had gone to the window, peering down into the street. He turned, and I saw that his face was pale, but glowing like a candle.
"Aye? They were a bit faster than I thought then," Jamie said ruefully, going to look out.
He turned from the window and smiled.
"It's good to see you, John, if only for the moment."
John's answering smile lit his eyes. He reached out a hand and touched Jamie's arm very briefly, as though wishing to assure himself that he was, in fact, solid.
"Yes," he said, reaching then for the door. "But come, down the back stair, or there's a hatchway to the attic, if you can get onto the roof."
Jamie looked at me, his heart in his eyes.
"I'll come back," he said, "when I can."
He lifted a hand toward me, but stopped with a grimace, turned abruptly to follow John, and they were gone, the sound of their footsteps nearly drowned by the noises from downstairs. I heard the door open below, and a rough male voice demanding entrance. Mrs. Fig, bless her intransigent little heart, was having none of it. I'd been sitting like Lot's wife, shocked into immobility, but at the sound of Mrs. Fig's rich expletives, was galvanized into action. My mind was so stunned by the events of the last 5 minutes that it was paradoxically quite clear. There was simply no room in it for thoughts, speculations, relief, joy, or even worry. The only mental faculty I still possessed, apparently, was the ability to respond to an emergency. I snatched my cap, crammed it on my head, and started for the door, stuffing my hair up into it as I went. Mrs. Fig and I together could surely delay the soldiers long enough. This scheme would probably have worked, save that, as I rushed out onto the landing, I ran into Willie,
literally as he came bounding up the stair and collided heavily with me. "Mother Clare, where's Papa? There are..." He had seized me by the arms as I reeled backward, but his concern for me was superseded by a sound from the hall beyond the landing. He glanced toward the sound, then let go of me, his eyes bulging. Jamie stood at the end of the hall, some 10 feet away. John stood beside him, white as a sheet, and his eyes bulging as much as Willie's were. This resemblance to Willie, striking as it was completely overwhelmed by Jamie's own resemblance to the 9th Earl of Ellesmere. William's face had hardened and matured, losing all trace of childish softness, and from both ends of the short hall, deep blue Fraser cat eyes stared out of the bold, solid bones of the Mackenzies. And Willie was old enough to shave on a daily basis. He knew what he looked like. Willie's mouth worked, soundless with shock. He looked wildly at me, back at Jamie, back at me, and saw the truth in my face. "Who are you?" he said hoarsely, wheeling on Jamie. I saw Jamie draw himself slowly upright, ignoring the noise below. "James Fraser," he said. His eyes were fixed on William with a burning intensity, as though to absorb every vestige of a sight he wouldn't see again. "You kent me once as Alex Mackenzie, at Hellwater." William blinked again, and his gaze shifted momentarily to John. "And who the bloody hell am I?" he demanded, the end of the question rising in a squeak. John opened his mouth, but it was Jamie who answered. "You are a stinking papist," he said very precisely. "And your baptismal name is James." The ghost of regret crossed his face and then was gone. "It was the only name I had a right to give you," he said quietly, eyes on his son. "I'm sorry." Willie's left hand slapped at his hip, reflexively looking for a sword. Finding none, he slapped at his chest. His hands were shaking so badly that he couldn't manage buttons. He simply seized the fabric and ripped open his shirt, reached in, and fumbled for something. He pulled it over his head and in the same motion hurled the object at Jamie. Jamie's reflexes brought his hand up automatically, and the wooden rosary smacked into it, the beads swinging, tangled in his fingers. "God damn you, sir," Willie said, voice trembling. "God damn you to hell." He half turned blindly, then spun on his heel to face John. "And you? You knew, didn't you? God damn you too, William." John reached out a hand to him, helpless, but before he could say anything more, there was a sound of voices in the hall below and heavy feet on the stair. "Sassenach, keep him back." Jamie's voice reached me through the hubbub, sharp and clear. By sheer reflex, I obeyed and seized Willie by the arm. He glanced at me, mouth open, completely nonplussed. "What?" His voice was drowned by the thunder of feet on the stairs and a triumphant whoop from the red coat in front. "There he is!" Suddenly the landing was thronged with bodies pushing and shoving, trying to get past Willie and me into the hallway. I clung like grim death despite the jostling and despite Willie's own belated efforts to free himself. All at once, the shouting stopped, and the press of bodies relaxed just a bit. My cap had been knocked over my eyes in the struggle, and I let go of Willie's arm with one hand in order to pull it off. I dropped it on the floor. I had a feeling that my status as a respectable woman wasn't going to be important for much longer. Brushing dishevelled hair out of my eyes with a forearm, I resumed my grip on Willie, though this was largely unnecessary as he seemed turned to stone. The redcoats were shifting on their feet, clearly ready to charge, but inhibited by something. I turned a little and saw Jamie, one arm wrapped round John Gray's throat, holding a pistol to John's temple.
"One step more," he said calmly, but loud enough to be easily heard, "and I put a ball through his brain. Do you think I've anything to lose?"
Actually, Given that Willie and myself were standing right in front of him, I rather thought he did. But the soldiers didn't know that, and judging from the expression on Willie's face, he would have torn his tongue out by the roots rather than blurt out the truth. I also thought he didn't particularly care at the moment if Jamie did kill John and then die in a fusillade of bullets. His arm was like iron under my grip. He'd have killed them both himself if he could. There was a murmur of menace from the men around me and a shifting of bodies, men readying themselves, but no one moved. Jamie glanced once at me, face unreadable, then moved toward the back stair, half dragging John with him. They vanished from view, and the corporal next to me sprang into action, turning and gesturing to his men on the stair. "Round back! Hurry! Hold!" Willie had come abruptly to life. Jerking his arm away from my slackened grip, he turned on the corporal. "Have you men posted at the back of the house?" The corporal, noticing Willie's uniform for the first time, straightened himself and saluted. "No, sir. I didn't think..." "Idiot," Willie said shortly. "Yes, sir. But we can catch them if we hurry, sir." He was rocking up onto his toes as he spoke, in an agony to be gone. Willie's fists were clenched, and so were his teeth. I could see the thoughts crossing his face as clearly as if they'd been printed on his forehead in movable type. He didn't think Jamie would shoot Lord John, but wasn't sure of it. If he sent men after them, there was a decent chance that the soldiers would catch up to them, which in turn meant some chance that one or both would die. And if neither died, but Jamie was captured, there was no telling what he might say or to whom. Too much risk. With a faint sense of déjà vu, I saw him make these calculations, then turn to the corporal. "Return to your commander," he said calmly. "Let him know that Colonel Grey has been taken hostage by the rebels, and ask him to notify all guard posts. I am to be informed at once of any news." There was a displeased murmur from the soldiers on the landing, but nothing that could actually be called insubordination. And even this died away in the face of William's glare. The corporal's teeth set briefly in his lip, but he saluted. "Yes, sir." He turned smartly on his heel with a peremptory gesture that sent the soldiers clumping heavily down the stair. Willie watched them go. Then, as though suddenly noticing it, he bent and picked up my cap from the floor. Kneading it between his hands, he gave me a long, speculative look. The next little while was going to be interesting, I saw. I didn't care. While I was quite sure that Jamie wouldn't shoot John under any circumstances, I was under no misapprehensions about the danger to either of them. I could smell it. The scent of sweat and gunpowder hung thick in the air on the landing, and the soles of my feet still vibrated from the slam of the heavy door below. None of it mattered. He was alive. And so was I. Grey was still in his shirt sleeves. The rain had cut through the cloth to his flesh. Jamie went to the shed's wall and put his eye to a crack between the boards. He raised a hand, adjuring silence, and John stood waiting, shivering, as the sound of hooves and voices went past. Who might it be? Not soldiers. There was no sound of brass, no jingling spurs or arms. The sounds faded, and Jamie turned back. He frowned, noticing for the first time that Grey was wet through, and, taking the cloak from his shoulders, wrapped it round him. The cloak was damp too, but made of wool, and Jamie's body heat lingered in it. Grey closed his eyes for an instant, embraced. "May I know what it is that you've been doing?" Grey inquired, opening them.
"When?"
Jamie gave him a half smile.
"Just now, or since I saw you last?"
"Just now."
"Ah."
Jamie sat down on a barrel and leaned back gingerly against the wall. Grey noted with interest that the sound was nearly "ach," and deduced that Fraser had spent much of his time of late with Scots.
He also observed that Fraser's lips were pursed in thought. The slanted blue eyes cut in his direction.
You sure you want to know? It's likely better if you don't.
I put considerable trust in your judgment and discretion, Mr. Fraser, Gray said politely, but somewhat more in my own. I'm sure you will forgive me.
Fraser appeared to find that funny. The wide mouth twitched, but he nodded and produced a small packet sewn in oilskin from inside his shirt.
I was observed in the act of accepting this from my foster son, he said. The person who saw me followed me to an ordinary, then went to fetch the nearest company of soldiers whilst I was refreshing myself. Or so I assume. I saw them coming down the street, supposed that it might be myself they sought, and left. You are familiar, I suppose, with the trope regarding the guilty who flee when no man pursues? How do you know they were after you to begin with, and not merely interested by your abrupt departure?
A half-smile flickered again, this time tinged with rue.
Call it the instinct of the hunted. Indeed. I am surprised that you allowed yourself to be cornered, as it were, your instincts being what they are. Aye, well, even foxes grow old, do they not?
Fraser said dryly.
Why the devil did you come to my house? Gray demanded, suddenly irritable. Why did you not run for the edge of town?
Fraser looked surprised.
My wife?
He said simply. It occurred to Gray, with a pang, that it hadn't been inadvertence or lack of caution that had impelled Jamie Fraser to come to his house, even with soldiers on his heels. He'd come for her. For Claire.
Jesus,
he thought with sudden panic.
Claire!
But there was no time to say anything. Even could he have thought what to say. Jamie rose, and taking the pistol from his belt, beckoned him to come. They went down an alleyway, then through the backyard of a pub, squeezing past the open brew tub, its surface pocked by falling rain. Smelling faintly of hops, they emerged into a street and slowed down. Jamie had gripped his wrist throughout this journey, and Lord John felt his hand beginning to go numb, but said nothing. They passed two or three groups of soldiers, but he walked with Jamie, matching him stride for stride, keeping his eyes front. There was no conflict of heart and duty here. To shout for help might result in Jamie's death. It almost surely would result in the death of at least one soldier. Jamie kept his pistol out of sight, half hidden in his coat, but in his hand, putting it back into his belt only when they reached the place where he had left his horse. It was a private house. He left Gray by himself on the porch for a moment with a muttered, "Stay here," while he disappeared inside. A strong sense of self-preservation urged Lord John to run, but he didn't, and was rewarded when Jamie emerged again and smiled a little, seeing him.
"So you weren't sure I'd stay?" "Fair enough," Gray thought. He hadn't been sure either. "Come on, then," Jamie said,
and with a jerk of his head beckoned Gray to follow him to the stable, where he quickly saddled and bridled a second horse, handing the reins to Gray before mounting his own.
"Pro forma," he said politely to Gray,
and, drawing the pistol, pointed it at him.
"Should anyone ask later? You'll come with me. And I will shoot you should you make any move to give me away before we're out of the city. We are understood, I hope."
"We are," Gray replied briefly, and swung up into the saddle. He rode a little ahead of Jamie, conscious of the small round spot between his shoulder blades. Pro forma or not, he'd meant it. He wondered whether Jamie would shoot him in the chest or simply break his neck when he found out.
Likely bare hands, he thought. It was a visceral sort of thing. Sex?
The idea of concealing the truth hadn't seriously occurred to him. He didn't know Claire Fraser nearly as well as Jamie did, but he knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that she couldn't keep secrets. Not from anyone. And certainly not from Jamie, restored to her from the dead. Of course,
It might be some time before Jamie was able to speak to her again. But he knew Jamie Fraser infinitely better than he knew Claire. And the one thing he was certain of was that nothing whatever would stand long between Jamie and his wife. The rain had passed, and the sun shone on the puddles as they splashed through the streets. There was a sense of movement all around, agitation in the air. The army was quartered in Germantown, but there were always soldiers in the city, and their knowledge of imminent departure, anticipation of the return to campaigning, infected the city like a plague, a fever passing invisibly from man to man. A patrol on the road out of the city stopped them, but waved them on when Grey gave his name and rank. His companion he introduced as Mr. Alexander Mackenzie, and thought he felt a vibration of humour from said companion. Alex Mackenzie was the name Jamie had used at Hellwater, as Grey's prisoner.
Oh, God, Grey thought suddenly, leading the way out of sight of the patrol. William.
In the shock of the confrontation and their abrupt departure, he hadn't had time to think. If Grey were dead, what would William do? His thoughts buzzed like a swarm of hiving bees crawling over one another in a seething mass, impossible to focus on one for more than an instant before it was lost in the deafening hum. Dennis Randall Isaacs, Richardson. With Grey gone, he would almost certainly move to arrest Claire. William would try to stop him if he knew. But William didn't know what Richardson was. Grey didn't know either, not for sure. Henry and his Negro lover. Grey knew that they were lovers now, had seen it in both their faces. Dottie and her Quaker. If the twin shocks didn't kill Hal, he'd be on a ship bound for America, in nothing flat, and that would certainly kill him. Percy. Oh, Jesus. Percy. Jamie was in front of him now, leading the way. There were little groups of people on the road, mostly farmers coming in with wagon loads of supplies for the army. They looked curiously at Jamie, much more so at Grey, but no one stopped or challenged them, and an hour later, Jamie led them down a trace off the main road and into a small woodland, dripping and steaming from the recent rain. There was a stream. Jamie swung down off his horse and left it to drink, and Grey did likewise, feeling strangely unreal, as though the leather of saddle and reins was foreign to his skin, as though rain-chilled air passed through him, body and bones, rather than around him. Jamie crouched by the stream and drank, then splashed water over his head and face, and stood up, shaking himself like a dog.
"Thank you, John," he said. "I hadn't time to say it earlier. I'm very grateful to you."
"Thank me? It was hardly my choice. You abducted me at gunpoint." Jamie smiled. The tension of the last hour had eased, and with it, the lines of his face.
"Not for that. For taking care of Claire, I mean."
"Claire," he repeated. "Ah, yes, that.
Aye, that," Jamie said patiently,
and bent a little to peer at him in concern.
"Are you quite well, John? You look a wee bit peaked."
"Peaked," Grey muttered. His heart was beating very erratically. Perhaps it would conveniently stop. He waited for a moment to allow it to do this, if it liked. But it went on, cheerfully thumping away.
"No help, then."
Jamie was still looking quizzically at him.
"Best to get it over quickly."
He took a deep breath, shut his eyes, and commended his soul to God.
"I have had carnal knowledge of your wife," he blurted.
He had expected to die more or less instantaneously upon this utterance. But everything continued just as usual. Birds continued chirping in the trees, and the rip and slobber of the horses champing grass was the only sound above that of the rushing water. He opened one eye to find Jamie Fraser standing there regarding him, head to one side, Oh, said Jamie curiously. Why?
Chapter 102. Bread in the Bone.
If you'll excuse me for a moment.
I backed slowly to the door of my room, and seizing the knob, whipped inside and shut the door, leaving Willie to recover himself in decent privacy. And not only Willie. I pressed myself against the door as though pursued by werewolves, my blood thundering in my ears.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I whispered.
Something like a geyser rose up inside me and burst in my head, the spray of it sparkling with sunlight and diamonds. I was dimly aware that it had come on to rain outside, and dirty grey water was streaking the window panes, but that didn't matter a bit to the effervescence inside me. I stood still for several minutes, eyes closed, not thinking anything, just murmuring, "Thank you, God," over and over, soundlessly. A tentative rap on the door jarred me out of this trance, and I turned to open it. William stood on the landing. His shirt still hung open where he'd torn it, and I could see the pulse beat fast in the hollow of his throat. He bowed awkwardly to me, trying to achieve a smile, but notably failing in the attempt. He gave it up.
"I am not sure what to call you," he said, "under the circumstances."
"Oh," I said, mildly disconcerted. "Well, I don't think, at least I hope, that the relationship between you and me hasn't changed." I realized, with a sudden dampening of my euphoria, that it very well might now, and the thought gave me a deep pang. I was very fond of him, for his own sake as well as for his father's, or father's, as the case might be.
"Could you bring yourself to go on calling me Mother Claire, do you think? Just until we can think of something more appropriate," I added hastily, seeing reluctance narrow his eyes. "After all, I suppose I am still your stepmother, regardless of the situation."
He turned that over for a moment, then nodded briefly.
"May I come in? I wish to talk to you." "Yes, I suppose you do."
If I hadn't known both his fathers, I should have marvelled at his ability to suppress the rage and confusion he had so clearly exhibited a quarter of an hour ago. Jamie did it by instinct, John by long experience. But both of them had an iron power of will, and whether William's was bred in the bone or acquired by example, he most assuredly had one.
"Shall I send for something?" I asked. "A little brandy? It's good for shock."
He shook his head. He wouldn't sit. I didn't think he could, but leaned against the wall.
"I suppose that you knew. You could scarcely help but notice the resemblance, I suppose," he added bitterly.
"It is rather striking," I agreed with caution. "Yes, I knew. My husband told me," I groped for some delicate way of putting it,
"the circumstances of your birth some years ago."
And just how was I going to describe those circumstances? It hadn't exactly escaped me that there were a few awkward explanations to be made. But caught up in the alarms of Jamie's sudden reappearance and escape, and the giddiness of my own subsequent euphoria, it somehow hadn't occurred to me that I would be the person making them. I'd seen the little shrine he kept in his room, the double portrait of his two mothers, both so heartbreakingly young. If age was good for anything, surely it should have given me the wisdom to deal with this. How could I tell him that he was the result of an impulsive, self-willed young girl's blackmail, let alone tell him that he had been the cause of both his legal parents' deaths? And if anyone was going to tell him what his birth had meant to Jamie, it was going to have to be Jamie.
"Your mother," I began, and hesitated.
Jamie would have taken the blame solely upon himself rather than blacken Geneva's memory to her son. I knew. I wasn't having that.
She was reckless, William said, watching me closely. Everybody says she was reckless.
Was it? I suppose I only want to know. Was it rape?
God, no, I said, horrified, and saw his fists uncurl a little.
That's good, he said, and let out the breath he'd been holding. You're sure he didn't lie to you?
I'm sure.
He and his father might be able to hide their feelings. I certainly couldn't. And while I would never be able to make a living playing cards, having a glass face was occasionally a good thing. I stood still and let him see that I told the truth.
Do you think... Did he say...
He stopped and swallowed hard.
Did they love each other, do you think?
As much as they could, I think, I said softly. They hadn't much time, only the one night. I ached for him and would have liked so much to take him in my arms and comfort him. But he was a man, and a young one, fierce about his pain. He'd deal with it as he could, and I thought it would be some years, if ever, before he learned to share it.
Yes, he said, and pressed his lips together as though he'd been going to say something else and thought better of it. Yes, I see. It was quite clear from his tone that he didn't, but reeling under the impact of realization, had no idea what to ask next, let alone what to do with the information he had.
I was born almost exactly 9 months after my parents' marriage, he said, giving me a hard look. Did they deceive my father? Or did my mother play the whore with her groom before she wed?
That might be a bit harsh, I began.
No, it isn't, he snapped.
Which was it?
Your fa...
Jamie. He'd never deceive another man in his marriage.
Except Frank, I thought a little wildly. But of course he hadn't known at first that he was doing it.
My father, he said abruptly. Pap. Lord John, I mean.
He knew?
Knows?
Yes. Thin ice again. I didn't think he had any idea that Lord John had married Isabel principally for his sake. And Jamie's. But didn't want him going anywhere near the question of Lord John's motives.
All of them, I said firmly, all four of them. They wanted what was best for you.
Best for me, he repeated bleakly.
Right.
His knuckles had gone white again, and he gave me a look through narrowed eyes that I recognized all too well. A Fraser about to go off with a bang. I also knew perfectly well that there was no way of stopping one from detonating, but had a try anyway, putting out a hand to him.
William, I began, believe me.
I do, he said. Don't bloody tell me any more. God damn it! And whirling on his heel, he drove his fist through the panelling with a thud that shook the room, wrenched his hand out of the hole he'd made, and stormed out. I heard crunching and rending as he paused to kick out several of the balusters on the landing, and rip a length of the stair railing off, and I made it to the door in time to see him draw back a foot-four chunk of wood over his shoulder, swing, and strike the crystal chandelier that hung over the stairwell in an explosion of shattering glass. For a moment, he teetered on the open edge of the landing, and I thought he would fall or hurl himself off, but he staggered back from the edge and threw the chunk of wood like a javelin at the remnant of the chandelier, with a burst of breath that might have been a grunt or a sob. Then he rushed headlong down the stairs, thumping his wounded fist at intervals against the wall where it left bloody smudges. He hit the front door with his shoulder, rebounded, jerked it open, and went out like a locomotive. I stood frozen on the landing in the midst of chaos and destruction, gripping the edge of the broken balustrade. Tiny rainbows danced on walls and ceiling like multicoloured dragonflies sprung out of the shattered crystal that littered the floor. Something moved. A shadow fell across the floor of the hall below. A small dark figure walked slowly in through the open doorway. Putting back the hood of her cloak, Jenny Fraser Murray looked round at the devastation, then up at me, her face a pale oval, glimmering with humour.
Like father, like son, I see, she remarked. God help us all.
Chapter 103. The Hour of the Wolf. The British army was leaving Philadelphia. The Delaware was choked with ships, and the ferries ran non-stop from the end of State Street across to Cooper's Point. 3,000 Tories were leaving the city too, afraid to stay without the army's protection. General Clinton had promised them passage, though their baggage made a dreadful mess, stacked on the docks, crammed into the ferries, and occupied a good deal of space on board the ships. Ian and Rachel sat on the riverbank below Philadelphia, under the shade of a drooping sycamore, and watched an artillery emplacement being disassembled 100 yards away. The artillerymen worked in shirt sleeves, their blue coats folded on the grass nearby, removing the guns that had defended the city, preparing them for shipping. They were in no hurry and took no particular notice of spectators. It didn't matter now.
"Does thee know where they are going?" Rachel asked.
"Aye, I do. Fergus says they're going north to reinforce New York."
"Thee has seen him?"
She turned her head, interested, and the leaf shadows flicked over her face.
"Aye, he came home last night. He'll be safe now, with the Tories and the army gone."
"Safe," she said, with a sceptical intonation. "As safe as anyone may be, in times like these, thee means."
She'd taken off her cap because of the heat, and brushed the damp, dark hair back from her cheeks. He smiled, but said nothing. She knew as well as he did what the illusions of safety were.
"Fergus says the British mean to cut the colonies in half," he remarked. "Separate north from south and deal with them separately."
"Does he? And how does he know this?" she asked, surprised.
"A British officer named Randall Isaacs. He talks to Fergus."
"He is a spy, thee means. For which side?"
Her lips compressed a little. He wasn't sure where spying fell in terms of Quaker philosophy, but didn't care to ask just now. It was a tender subject, Quaker philosophy.
"I shouldn't have liked to have to guess," he said. "He passes himself off as an American agent, but that may be all moonshine. You cannot trust anyone in wartime, eh?"
She turned round to look at him at that, hands behind her back as she leaned against the sycamore.
"Can thee not?"
"I trust you," he said, "and your brother."
"And thy dog," she said, with a glance at Rollo, writhing on the ground to scratch his back.
"Thy aunt and uncle too, and Fergus and his wife? That seems a fair number of friends."
She leaned toward him, squinting in concern.
"Does thy arm pain thee?"
"Oh, that's well enough."
He shrugged with his good shoulder, smiling. His arm did hurt, but the sling helped. The axe blow had nearly severed his left arm, cutting through the flesh and breaking the bone. His aunt said he had been lucky in that it had not damaged the tendons.
"The body is plastic," she said. "Muscle would heal, and so would bone."
Rollo's had. There was no trace of stiffness from the gunshot wound, and while his muzzle was growing white, he slid through the bushes like an eel, sniffing industriously. Rachel sighed and gave him a direct look under dark, level brows.
"Ian, thee is thinking something painful, and I would much prefer thee tells me what it is. Has something happened?"
A great many things had happened, were happening all around them, would continue to happen. How could he tell her? And yet, he couldn't not.
"The world is turning upside down," he blurted. "And you are the only constant thing. The only thing that binds me to the earth."
Her eyes softened.
"Am I?"
"You ken very well that you are," he said gruffly.
He looked away, his heart pounding. Too late, he thought, with a mixture of dismay and elation. He'd begun to speak. He couldn't stop now, no matter what might come of it.
"I know what I am," he said, awkward but determined. I would turn Quaker for your sake, Rachel. But I ken I'm not one in my heart. I think I never could be. And I think you wouldna want me to say words I didna mean, or pretend to be something I canna be.
No, she said softly. I would not want that. He opened his mouth but couldn't find more words to say. He swallowed, dry-mouthed, waiting. She swallowed too. He saw the slight movement of her throat, soft and brown.
The sun had begun to touch her again, the nut-brown maiden ripening from winter's pale bloom. The artillerymen loaded the last of the cannon into a wagon, hitched their limbers to teams of oxen, and with laughter and raucous talk moved up the road toward the ferry point. When they were gone at last, a silence fell. There were still noises, the sound of the river, the rustle of the sycamore, and, far beyond, the bellowings and crashings of an army on the move, the sound of violence impending. But between them, there was silence.
I've lost, he thought.
But her head was still bent in thought.
Is she maybe praying, or only trying to think how to send me away?
Whichever it was, she lifted her head and stood up, away from the tree. She pointed at Rollo, who was lying couchant now, motionless but alert, yellow eyes following every movement of a fat robin foraging in the grass. That dog is a wolf, is he not?
Aye, well, mostly.
A small flash of hazel told him not to quibble.
And yet he is thy boon companion, a creature of rare courage and affection, and altogether a worthy being.
Oh, aye, he said with more confidence. He is.
She gave him an even look.
Thee is a wolf too, and I know it. But thee is my wolf, and best thee know that.
It started to burn when she spoke, an ignition swift and fierce as the lighting of one of his cousin's matches. He put out his hand, palm forward to her, still cautious, lest she too burst into flame.
What I said to you before, that I kent you loved me.
She stepped forward and pressed her palm to his, her small, cool fingers linking tight.
What I say to thee now is that I do love thee, and if thee hunts at night, thee will come home.
Under the sycamore, the dog yawned and laid his muzzle on his paws.
And sleep at thy feet,
Ian whispered, and gathered her in with his one good arm, both of them blazing bright as day.
The End. You've been listening to An Echo in the Bone by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter and directed by Kathleen Gormley. The author concludes this book with the following afterword, read once again by Davina Porter.
Author's Notes. Brigadier General Simon Fraser. There are, as anyone who's read my books will already realise, a lot of Simon Frasers running around the 18th century. The brigadier who fought gallantly and was killed at Saratoga is not one of the Frasers of Lovat, but a Fraser of Balnain. That is, not a direct descendant of the old fox, but certainly a relation of the family. He had an illustrious military career, including the famous taking of Quebec with James Wolfe in 1759, which battle forms a part of a novella entitled The Custom of the Army, a Lord John Grey story which will be published in March of 2010 as part of an anthology titled Warriors, in case you want more details. My reason for mentioning the brigadier particularly, though, is the interesting matter of his grave. Most accounts of Saratoga that mention Simon Fraser of Balnain report that he was buried in the evening of the day he died within the boundaries of the Great Redoubt, not Braemans Redoubt, which Jamie stormed with Benedict Arnold, but the larger one on the field, at his own request. Some accounts add details, such as the attendance of Balcarres Rangers,
or of the Americans firing a minute gun in Fraser's honour when they realised what was taking place, while other accounts consider these romantic but probably apocryphal details, and say that he was attended only by the close members of his staff. Now, it isn't always possible to go in person to a place you're writing about, nor is it always necessary. It is usually desirable, though, and luckily Saratoga is pretty accessible, and the battlefield there is well preserved and curated. I've walked the field there 3 times over the course of several years since I first decided that I wanted to use this particular battle as a centerpiece of a book, if not the book I happened to be writing at the time. On one of these occasions, I was there alone. There were no other tourists. And I got into conversation with one of the park employees, dressed in period costume, and posted at the rebuilt site of the Bemis farm. After he patiently answered a lot of intrusive questions, "Are you wearing underwear?" being one of them, and "No" being the answer, "long shirt tails" being the further explanation of how one avoids chafing while wearing homespun breeches, allowed me to handle his brown Bess musket and explain the loading and firing of it. We got into a discussion of the battle and its personalities, since I did, at this point, know quite a lot about it. General Fraser's grave was, at that point, noted on the Park Service map, but it wasn't in the Great Redoubt. It was located near the river. I'd been down there, but found no marker for it, and so inquired where it was, and why wasn't it in the Great Redoubt? I was informed that the Park Service had at one point, I don't know when, but fairly recently, done an archaeological excavation of the Great Redoubt, including the supposed gravesite. To everyone's surprise, General Fraser was not buried there, nor was anyone else. There were signs that a grave had once been dug, and a uniform button was found there, but no signs whatever of a body. And while the body itself would be long since decomposed, you would expect still to see some signs. There was, the employee told me, an account that said that General Fraser's grave had been moved to a site near the river, and that was why the map was so marked. But no one knew where the specific place was, or in fact, whether the general was in that one either, which was why there was no marker there. Well, novelists are a conscienceless lot. Those of us who deal with history tend to be fairly respectful of such facts as are recorded, always bearing in mind the proviso that just because it's in print, it isn't necessarily true. But give us a hole to slide through, an omission in the historic record, one of those mysterious lacunae that occur in even the best documented life. So, all in all, I rather thought that perhaps General Fraser had been sent home to Scotland. Yes, they did send bodies to and fro in the 18th century on occasion. Someone exhumed poor old Tom Paine from his grave in France, intending to ship him back to America so he could be interred there with honour as a prophet of the Revolution. His body was lost in transit, and no one's ever found it. Speaking of interesting lacunae. Anyway, as it happened, I went to Scotland last year, and while wandering round the countryside in search of a logical place near Balmain in which to plant General Fraser, stumbled over, literally, the large chambered cairn at Corrimooney. Such sights are always evocative. And when I read on the sign posted there that there had once been a body in the central chamber, but it had evidently decayed into the soil, there were traces of bones left in the earth even after 1,000 years or more, and that the tomb had been broken into sometime in the 19th century, thus explaining why you won't find anything in the cairn if you happen to go there now. Well, hey. People always ask novelists where they get their ideas. Everywhere. Quaker Plain Speech. The Religious Society of Friends was founded around 1647 by George Fox. As part of the Society's belief in the equality of all men before God, they did not use honorific titles such as Mr. Mrs., General, Colonel, etc., and used plain speech in addressing everyone. Now,
As any of you who know a second language with Latin roots, Spanish, French, etc., realize, these languages have both a familiar and a formal version of you. So did English once upon a time. The thee and thou forms that most of us recognize as Elizabethan or biblical are, in fact, the English familiar forms of you, with you used as both the plural familiar form, all y'all, and the formal pronoun, both singular and plural. As English evolved, the familiar forms were dropped, leaving us with the utilitarian you to cover all contingencies. Quakers retained the familiar forms, though, as part of their plain speech until the 20th century. Over the years, though, plain speech also evolved, and while thee-thy remained, thou-thine largely disappeared, and the verb forms associated with thee-thy changed. From about the mid-18th century onward, plain speech used thee as the singular form of you. The plural form remained you, even in plain speech, with the same verb forms normally used for third-person singular. For example, he knows that, thee knows that. The older verb endings, knowest, doth, etc., were no longer used. Scots, Scotch, Scottish. As noted elsewhere, Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade, see author's notes, in the 18th century, and indeed well into the mid-20th century, the word Scotch and its variants, for example, Scotchman, were commonly used by both English people and Scots to describe an inhabitant of Scotland. The terms Scottish and Scots were also occasionally used, though less common. Typos and terminology. There may be an impulse to regard the term mess kid, as used in part 3 of this book, as a typographical error. It's not. A mess kid was a shallow circular bucket in which sailors of the 18th and 19th centuries were served their food. A mess kit, on the other hand, referred to the utensils carried and used by a soldier. By the same token, while crotch is the usual American English term, the older form, crutch, would have been used in the 18th century usage. Which is not to say there aren't any typographical errors in this book. Despite the heroic efforts of Ms. Cathy Lord, the copy editor, the alerts of various friends and translators who read the manuscript in chunks, and a fair amount of diligence by myself, these things happen. But these particular terms aren't. Saratoga. A tremendous amount of historical research goes into a book like this. I'm often bemused by letters from people telling me they'd visited a museum, seen some 18th century artifacts, and been struck all a heap by discovering that I hadn't just made it all up. And while there isn't room to acknowledge or list even a fraction of the sources I've used, I did want to mention one specific book. The two battles of Saratoga were historically important, remarkably dramatic, and very complex, both in the logistics of the battle and in the troop movements and politics that led up to them. I was fortunate to find early on in my researches Richard M. Ketchum's Saratoga, which is an amazingly well-done portrait of the battles, the background, and the plethora of colourful individuals who took part. I just wanted to recommend this book to those of you with a deeper interest in the historical aspects, as these could only be touched on lightly in the context of a novel. Loch Erechty and Tunnel Tigers. During the 1950s and 60s, a great hydroelectric scheme was implemented in the Scottish Highlands. The work of a great many tunnel tigers, also known as the hydro boys, labourers, many of them from Ireland and Poland, went into digging tunnels through the mountains and building dams for the creation of man-made lochs. Loch Erechty is, in fact, one of these man-made lochs. The tunnel I've drawn as being associated with it, complete with miniature train, is like those common to the hydroelectric scheme as a whole, but I don't know that there actually is one at Loch Erechty. On the other hand, the dam,
turbine service chamber, and fish viewing chamber at Pitlochry are indeed all there. So are the anglers.
This ends Diana Gabaldon's afterword to An Echo in the Bone. This book is copyrighted 2009 by Diana Gabaldon. This recording is copyrighted 2009 by Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The White Queen by Philippa Gregory, narrated by Susan Lyons. Brother turns on brother to win the ultimate prize, the throne of England, in this dazzling account of the Wars of the Plantagenets. They are the claimants and kings who ruled England before the Tudors, and now Philippa Gregory brings them to life through the dramatic and intimate stories of the secret players. The indomitable women, starting with Elizabeth Woodville, the White Queen. With her extraordinary beauty and ambition, she catches the eye of the newly crowned boy king, marries him in secret, and ascends to royalty. While Elizabeth rises to the demands of her exalted position and fights for the success of her family, her two sons become central figures in a mystery that has confounded historians for centuries. The missing princes in the Tower of London, whose fate is still unknown. Philippa Gregory explores this most famous unsolved mystery of English history, informed by impeccable research and framed by her inimitable storytelling skills. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Jamie's shoulders moved slowly as he sighed, and his own voice was nearly as tired as Stebbing's.
No, he said, very softly. Call it payment of a debt.
A debt? I thought. To whom? To the Lord Melton, who had declined to kill him out of honour, who had instead sent him home from Culloden, hidden in a wagon filled with hay? To his sister, who had refused to let him die, who had dragged him back to life by sheer strength of will? Or to those who had died when he had not? I had stretched myself enough now to be able to rise, but didn't yet. There was no urgency. The men were silent, their breathing part of the breathing of the ship, the sigh of the sea outside. It came to me, quiet but sure, that I knew. I had glimpsed the abyss often over someone's shoulder as they stood on the edge looking down. But I had looked once too. I knew the vastness and the lure of it, the offer of surcease. I knew they were standing now, side by side, and each alone, looking down.